In our last lesson in Genesis, we just got into this 26th chapter. I'd like to read the first two verses again. And there was a famine in the land, besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went unto Abimelech, king of the Philistines, unto Gerar. And the Lord appeared unto him and said, Go not down into Egypt, dwell in the land which I shall tell thee of. So here Isaac and Rebekah are going to have a trial of their faith and of their courage. The trial of a famine. Hadn't been a famine in about 100 years now. And so this was a big thing. It was an important thing. They were in danger probably of having a lot of their possessions completely wiped out by this famine. But the Lord told Isaac, don't go into Egypt. That's what Abraham did before. It was a mistake. Stay in this land. And so it seems that Isaac was inclined to go over toward the coastal area where the Philistines were. That would still be in the land. And the Lord appeared to him and told him to stay in this land. Verse 3 says, Sojourn in this land, and I will be with thee and will bless thee. For unto thee and unto thy seed will I give all these countries, and I will perform the oath which I swore unto Abraham thy father. So he renews the promise to Isaac here, the promise that he made to Abraham. I'm going to fulfill the promise I made to Abraham, is what he's really saying. I'll give thee all the countries in this land. Your seed are going to inhabit them. And of course that did come to pass. Isaac was the one through whom the seed would come. And he says in verse 4, And I will make thy seed to multiply as the stars of heaven, and I will give unto thy seed all these countries, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Simply renewing Abraham's promise. And that promise included the fact that his offspring would have these countries and this land given to him. All the nations that lived here now would really be their inhabitants, their possessions at a future time. And then he says, And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. That's going to be the promise of the Messiah. The Messiah would come through his seed, through his offspring. And of course, that's the thing that applies to us today. Then God tells why he does this. In verse 5, he says, Because that Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. He doesn't say, I'm doing it because you're faithful, Isaac, or because anything you have done. It's because of Abraham. And this might be kind of a way to give Isaac a rebuke in that maybe Isaac had not been as faithful as God wanted to be. Isaac had not been as strong in obeying him as Abraham had been. But nevertheless, Abraham is one upon whom this all hinged. It's very interesting how he makes this statement about what Abraham did. He obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. And as you look up these various words here, we see that this would include any kind of a duty or command or suggestion or desire that God would have for Abraham to do. Voice would be any kind of a sound that he would make, a call that he would make to Abraham. Charge includes the idea of duty and law and being a sentry and service to God. Commandments includes any command or law or ordinance or precept that God would make to him. Any action that God wanted him to do would be a command. Statutes are more permanent binding ordinances from God. And generally we think of statutes being something that's written law. We don't know that anything was written at this time. But we don't know that it wasn't written. There may be some things that were written for Abraham to do. And then the word laws means a precept or a statute. And this is the word that's used many times in the Old Testament when applying to the law of Moses, to the Decalogue, to the Ten Commandments. Now we know that Abraham did not have the law of Moses. The law of Moses hadn't been given yet. And we have no statement that the Ten Commandments had been given yet. But anything that God wanted Abraham to do would come under one of these words that he uses in verse 5. It's very interesting to see how he mentions all of these things in these various phrases so that God may have spoken to Abraham, such as when he told him to leave Ur of the Chaldees. He may have spoken to him about the things that were going to happen to Lot whenever the city of Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. He may have spoken to Abraham about the battle that he had when he went to the fight the kings and rescue Lot that time. I'm sure he spoke to Abraham about the things he desired for Hagar and Ishmael. Abraham was told how to worship God, how to build the altar, how to make the sacrifice. He was told how to dwell in this land that he was supposed to eventually inherit through his seed. He was told about how to take Isaac and offer him. On and on, Abraham had many conversations, many contacts with God, and especially when God renewed time and time again the promises that he made to Abraham and told him about the promised son that would come. So these statements in verse 5 include all of the contacts that Abraham had with God, whether it was God speaking directly to him, or whether it was speaking through an angel, or something that maybe was a written law that Abraham had gotten from God. Now we know that the Bible teaches that Abraham was made acceptable to God by his faith. Abraham believed God and it was counted on him for righteousness. But let's note here in this verse that he says, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, my laws. So Abraham did something more than just have a belief in God. He obeyed and he kept. Obeyed and kept implies some action, implies some work, some doing on the part of Abraham. That's why God is blessing Isaac. That's why God is carrying through with all these promises he made to Abraham, because Abraham obeyed and kept. And so today when we have faith, and we certainly have faith that's similar to the faith of Abraham, but our faith, like Abraham's, includes the idea of obeying and keeping, obeying and doing something, being active in God's work. That's what it includes. We're told in 2 Thessalonians that those who would be lost would be those who did not obey the gospel, because they obeyed not the gospel. So there's an obeying, a keeping, a doing that should be carried out on our part as a result of our faith. Faith is going to bring these things about. Otherwise, faith without works, according to James, is dead. It's like the body without the spirit. Verse 6 says, and Isaac dwelt in Gerar. So Isaac now decided that he would not go to Egypt, since God forbid him to do so. And so he stayed in this place known as Gerar. Gerar was in the southwest corner of Canaan, getting down close to the edge of the land. It was in the possession of the Philistines at this time. Now, the Philistines still mainly lived on the island of Crete, but some of them had come to the mainland, and they had a colony here, and the king was named Abimelech. This name Abimelech seems to be the name that they applied to all their kings, like the Romans used the name Caesar for their emperors. Now, remember, Abraham had come here 100 years before, and there was an Abimelech here then. Now, this is not the same Abimelech 100 years later. He may have heard about Abraham and knew about him, knew of his fame, but this was a different man. Verse 7 says, and the men of the place asked him of his wife, and he said, she is my sister. For he feared to say, she is my wife, lest, said he, the men of the place should kill me for Rebekah, because she was fair to look upon. So here we find, incredibly, that Isaac repeats the same mistake that Abraham had made 100 years before. Abraham came 100 years before and had repeated his mistake now for the second time. He did it in Egypt. Now he did it again in Gerar among the Philistines, saying that Sarah was his sister, and when the king took her into his harem, then he became ill, and the whole group of them were in danger of dying because of this. God appeared unto the king in a dream and told him what was happening. And then a correction was made. Abraham was rebuked, actually, and Sarah was restored back to him. Well, we see Isaac making the same mistake. He comes to the same area. And here is another king by the same name of Abimelech. And he says that she is my sister. For he feared to say she's my wife, lest the men of the place would kill him. For Rebekah was fair to look upon. Now, Rebekah was about 60 years old at this time, but yet she was still fair to look upon. She was a very desirable woman for a man to have, to lust after. And so Isaac was afraid to tell the truth. Now, what Abraham did when he said that Sarah is my sister, he told a half-truth there. She was his half-sister. It was partly the truth, although he was deceptive in concealing the fact that she was his wife. But Isaac doesn't even tell a half-truth. Rebekah is his cousin, actually, then later his wife. So no way was she his sister. But he told this very same story, made the very same mistake, and we see that great people, holy people, can sometimes make serious mistakes. They can sin. They can do things that are very foolish because they're just human. So those that think they stand should take heed lest they fall, for the greatest have fallen. And we need to be careful not to walk in their steps when they take a misstep. We need to know what is right and what's wrong and not just follow someone else's example without knowing whether or not they're doing the right thing or not. And we have an aptness to imitate even the weaknesses and the poor judgments of those that we have a high regard for. So when we have a good respect for someone, let's still be cautious not to let them lead us by their error into committing the same kind of an error. There's also a lesson here to those who have fallen, not to give up and to think that there's not help for you. You can repent, you can be forgiven, and you can come back into the good favor of God, even though you have fallen. But it seemed that in spite of the lie that Isaac told about Rebekah being his sister, that still the men of this country had a certain amount of respect for him, and they did not approach Rebekah or take her in to be their wife. Verse 8 says, "And it came to pass, when he had been there a long time, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out at a window and saw and beheld Isaac was sporting with Rebekah his wife." So evidently, Rebekah and Isaac's tent was not far from Abimelech's residence, and Abimelech was able to look out and look down upon the tent or the courtyard and see them. And so one day he looked out and he saw Isaac sporting with Rebekah his wife. Now exactly what he was doing here, we're not told, but he was doing something that showed a certain amount of familiarity that he had with Rebekah that he wouldn't have with his sister. He was either laughing and playing with her, or perhaps doing something even more familiar that a husband would do to a wife that he would not do to a sister. And so Abimelech saw real quickly that this was not a sister, that he was treating Rebekah like a wife. Verse 9 says, "And Abimelech called Isaac and said, Behold, of a surety she is thy wife." So he had him caught here. "I know for sure she's your wife. She's not your sister. You wouldn't treat your sister like this. And how saidest thou, she is my sister? And Isaac said unto him, Because I said, lest I die for her." So Isaac had to confess and tell the truth. He told the lie simply because he was afraid that he would have to die for his wife. He was afraid the men would kill him to be able to get Rebekah as their own. That's what he's saying here, and that's the truth. And so verse 10 says, "And Abimelech said, What is this that thou hast done to us? One of the people might lightly have lain with thy wife, and thou shouldest have brought guiltiness upon us." So Abimelech just tells him very plainly, somebody could have taken your wife and had a sexual relation with her. If that had happened, we would have been guilty of taking another man's wife. You would have made us guilty because you told us this lie. And so as Abimelech rebukes Isaac, He strongly implies that he and his people had a much higher standard of morality than Isaac gave them credit for. Adultery with his wife, which might have happened, had Isaac told the truth from the very beginning, would have involved his whole nation to be guilty before God. Now, of course, we don't read anything here about Jacob and Esau. They probably were left back at the original place. In spite of the drought, to care for the things that were left behind, had Isaac and Rebekah come with these two grown sons, it would have been very obvious that she was his wife then. So they no doubt were not here. And so we wonder about this surprising moral sensitivity of this Philistine king. If his people were really so concerned about their morality, it seems strange that Isaac would have been so fearful of them. Either he was a poor judge of character, or else the Philistine men were somehow constrained to follow a different standard with respect to Isaac and Rebekah than they would with other people. And they might have heard of this similar experience with Abraham 100 years ago when the nation almost died as that earlier Abimelech took Sarah into his harem. In some way, at any rate, though, God kept the men from Rebekah. Then, surprisingly, Abimelech, instead of taking vengeance on Isaac for his deception, he made a law that anyone would be put to death if they harmed either Isaac or Rebekah. So they did come through this okay. No doubt God had a hand in this. This was a great error on the part of Isaac and Rebekah, and of course it was something they would need to have repented of and get forgiveness of before they did tell a lie. Satan had to be involved in this also. Satan and God and the two parties who told the lie. But God certainly won out. God's promise and his covenant was all important, and either adultery or murder on the part of either of these principal subjects was not going to be allowed by God. And verse 12 says, "Then Isaac sowed in that land and received in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed him." So Isaac evidently rented some land or was allowed the use of some land in this area. He had been a raiser of herds up to this time, the sheep and goats, and had not been a farmer. But now he probably decided he needed to diversify because of this famine and not just have all of his benefits come from one area of farming and ranching. He needed to start planting some crops. So he sowed in that land and received in the same year 100-fold. Now this is the first time sowing is mentioned in the Bible. It's used as a figure many times of sowing, like when we sow God's word and we plant the seed and expect it to bring forth some benefit. It's also interesting to note that he says he received 100-fold in that year. We read in Matthew 13 in the parable of the sower, we see what happened to the seed that fell on the good ground. In verse 23, "But he that receives seed into the good ground is he that heareth the word and understandeth it, which also beareth fruit and bringeth forth some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. So here we read of sowing the word of God as seed, and it falling on good ground and bringing forth 100-fold. Well, Isaac brought forth 100-fold. And the amazing thing is, it's the same year that he brought forth 100-fold. This was the year of the drought. This is the year when Isaac had to leave and come here to try to find something to keep from going under because of the drought. But his seed prospered 100-fold. Evidently, those around about him did not do that. So it happened that God prospered Isaac. And so those that were with Isaac would also prosper too. And naturally, the people around about him would have to prosper some, because as Isaac grew and prospered and had more goods, somehow or other, they could benefit from this, either by trading or buying or getting jobs or whatever, because the Lord had blessed him. Verse 13 says, "And the man waxed great and went forward and grew until he became very great." So he grew. His household grew. His servants grew. His possessions grew. He was prosperous. He became very great. Very great for the matter of fact of the fact that he had a lot of possessions here. Verse 14, "For he had possessions of flocks and possession of herds and great store of servants, and the Philistines envied him." So Isaac had plenty. This idea of planting and sowing and raising crops so he could feed his cattle, so he could feed his animals even though there was a drought, it paid off very greatly here. And had great store of servants. But the Philistines envied him. Now this is another sin that rears its ugly head here that we need to be on the lookout for. Envy is simply the having of a bad feeling because someone else does well. That's all envy is. It doesn't mean that this other person is hurting you anyway. This person is not depriving you of anything. This person is not hindering you from doing well yourself. But this person is prospering and you have a bad feeling because of his or her prosperity. That's what it amounts to. And so envy then can certainly color our judgment. It can make us do things that we shouldn't do, feel ways we shouldn't feel, and certainly desire to bring about some kind of ill feeling, some kind of harm to this person because they are prospering. So the Philistines envied him. Now this was not smart. Envy is never a smart thing to do. First of all, it only puts you in a bad frame of mind so that you really can't think straight about reality. You are so possessed with the idea of trying to deter this other person from doing well that you hinder yourself in the process. Secondly, in the case of Isaac here, his prosperity simply would have helped the other Philistines. It couldn't hurt him, it would help them. As he grew in possessions of flocks, as he had a great store of servants, had more herds, he would have to have the Philistines to come in and aid and assist him, and he would be spending money in the community. It's like when a tourist goes to an area, he's not going there to take somebody's job away from them, he's going there to spend money that he's made. And so he can only prosper the area. And smart communities appeal to the tourist trade. They want them to come there. They pamper them, do everything they can to get them to come, because that's their income, that's money for them. And so the smart thing here would have been to have allowed Isaac to continue to prosper. He can only do us good here, actually. But they envied him, which means that they're going to try to do something now to deter his progress. They're going to try to do something to harm him. Verse 15 says, "For all the wells which his father's servants had digged in the days of Abraham, his father, the Philistines had stopped them and filled them with earth." So Abraham had been in this country, we know, before, and he dug wells here, wells that would brought forth needed water so the herds could prosper. Well, these Philistines didn't have that many herds, evidently. They were poor, so they stopped up the wells. Not even going to help them in to stop up wells. If not going to help them to cut off the water supply, it's just going to make the country more desolate, harder to work it and be successful. But they did it to spite Isaac, and it filled him with earth. Verse 16, "And Abimelech said unto Isaac, Go from us, for thou art mightier than we." You've grown so much, Isaac. You are so great now that you're greater than we are. Leave us. And we're going to see that Isaac did just that. He didn't fight. He didn't put up any kind of resistance. He didn't try to deter them from their thoughts about him. He simply pulled up stakes and left to another area. We must conclude our lesson at that point. In our next lesson, Lord willing, we'll begin with the 17th verse of this 26th chapter of Genesis. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.